And good morning, and welcome to Word of Mouth. I'm your host, Jim Wunderlich, and today I'll be chatting with Connie Kowal, Director of Recreation and the Libertyville Sports Complex. Connie has been a Chicago sports executive for over 34 years. He has served in many key front office positions, including 14 seasons with the Chicago Cubs and 3 seasons with the New Orleans Saints, as well as new or growth franchises, including professional soccer, motorsports, the XFL, indoor lacrosse, and arena football. And Connie, thanks so much for revisiting the program. Great to have you back. Great to see you. You're looking good.
You are too, Jim. It's great to be back on the show. We had so much fun last year. I'm looking forward to a nice hour today.
Well, you know, last time you were here, so much fun talking about your career, particularly with the I believe we were talking about the Chicago Sting and spent a lot of time talking about the Chicago Cubs. And boy, you had so many neat stories. We were just getting warmed up and talked about the night game in Wrigley Field in 1988, President Reagan's first pitch, the All-Star game in 1990, just lots going on and neat stories. And, you know, just recently, Ernie Banks, who I thought would live forever, just passed away recently. And you got to see him up close and personal. What are your memories of old Mr. Cub?
Well, first of all, he's one of the greatest ball players ever. And growing up in Chicago, and you and I were guys that grew up in Glen Ullin together, we all wanted to be Ernie Banks. So you watch Ernie Banks play, you want to be Ernie Banks, you want to wear number 14 like Ernie Banks. And if you remember, we would play baseball in my backyard. You would imitate Ernie Banks with the fingers wiggling and the bat up in the air. Everybody wanted to be Ernie, so he was someone that, as a fan, you idolized. You go to the ballpark and watch. And then I work for the Cubs, and now I get to not only meet Mr. Cub, work with Mr. Cub, and you become a first-name friend with Mr. Cub. So for him to see me and go, Connie Kowal, how you doing, Connie Kowal? And you're like, hey, Ernie, how you doing? You become friends, and then become really good friends. And that's why when he passed away, it was very, very sad, but I was very, very honored to be at the funeral, at the memorial service, January 31st, ironically, which would have been his 84th birthday, and to be there to pay special moments with my good friend Ernie Banks.
As many luminaries were,
yeah,
in addition to all the folks of Chicago.
Yeah,
we were either glued to the TV or the radio listening to the service.
It was almost as if Cooperstown came to Chicago to respect Ernie with Hank Aaron and Reggie Jackson and Joe Torre. It was incredible. Besides his teammates from the 69 Cubs, as well as people who worked with him, or people that just touched, their lives were touched by Ernie Banks. We all were touched by Ernie Banks, and we'll miss him. And this one hurt because this is our youth.
So do you recall the first time you met Ernie Banks, not as a fan, but now working in the front office with the Chicago Cubs?
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, it was I joined the Cubs in 85, and we had a special event that year. It was an old-timers game with Cubs players and Cincinnati Reds players, and that's the first time that I had a chance to work with Ernie, and he was magic, and he was the same kind of guy that you saw on TV, you heard on radio, on the field, and he was so nice, and he was great to me. He was fantastic to me, and he gave me a lot of good advice. So he was special, but I met him in 85, and he was just great. And we always included him on special events at Wrigley. He's Mr. Cub, and so he was always a part of our big events on the field.
Now, you were just mentioning the 1969 Cubs, which is one that we grew up with, we were talking about. And one of my favorite players on there was Ron Santo. You had to like Ron. And of all the Cub players, I mean, he made the transition to the broadcast booth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you were around at that time.
Yep.
When he was making that transition. Did that go smoothly for him?
Well, as a matter of fact, you know, and we can reflect on it later, but Ernie did some broadcasting too.
Now, see, I don't recall that.
Yeah, Ernie did some, a couple times when Ernie was hurt, he'd go upstairs and do radio or TV with either Jack Brickhouse or Vince Lloyd and spend some time up there. He wasn't playing, he wasn't activated, so he went up there. The other thing that Ernie did, and again, back when we were kids, Ernie would do WGN TV sports sometimes. And so he'd
be... Oh, my goodness. You are right about that. All of a sudden, I just got the light bulb.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he'd have that blazer on with the Channel 9
oh,
logo.
My goodness. You're right. Yeah.
And, you know, he would say, he would say when he would get to the Cub games, and he would say, show the highlights, and they go, in the sixth inning, I had the opportunity to step up to the plate. And it would show the highlight with Jack Brickhouse going, oh boy, hey, home run Bernie Banks, wee, and all that. And he'd go, wow, that was such a thrill today. In hockey, Bobby Hull scored 2 goals, and it was Ernie all the way. But
well, you are dead on with that impression, I want to tell you. Wow.
I've hung around with Ernie a long time, and so... like I said, he'll be missed. That one hurt when with the passing of Ernie. He was such a dear friend. But Ron Santo, he had his different business ventures after baseball. But
pizza, right?
Pizza. He was in the oil business with Torco Oil, and it was based
that
in the western suburbs. And he was
very
much a successful businessman with that.
Hmm.
And then broadcasting became an opportunity when there was an opening for the color analyst for radio. And Ron auditioned, got the job, and his first day in the broadcast booth, opening day, you know, they had spring training in Mesa, but now it's opening day Wrigley Field, and his play-by-play guy is the great Tom Brenneman. And they decide on opening day, which sometimes is a chilly day, to have the window open in the press box because you have to decide early because you have to move it up or down and you can't do it in the middle of the game. So they say, let's put the window up to get the crowd noise. It may be cold. And Tom Brenneman welcomes the broadcast listener just like every radio play-by-play guy has done on GN for years, whether it's Vince Lloyd, Jack Quinlan, all the way back. And it's the usual, the Chicago Cubs are on the air. From Wrigley Field in Chicago, it's opening day. Well, that's the scripted lingo that's been done for decades. Opening game, Ron's next to Tom, and I'll probably get in trouble saying this. I'll probably break 15 FCC violations, but Santo said it, so what the heck. But Brenneman said, and the Chicago Cubs are on the air, and all of a sudden you hear, God damn it. And a gust of wind came into the booth and knocked Santo's coffee cup all over his lap and scorecard, this hot coffee.
Oh, my gosh.
Ron's first words on the air were, GD it. And Brenneman tells me he looks at him, stares, and goes, oh, my gosh, and goes, along with Cub legend Ron Santo, this is Tom Brenneman. And those were the first words that are uttered by Ron, and he obviously... went from there and had a terrific career as a color commentator.
Well, you know, that was the gift of him, though, too. What you heard is what you got. What you saw is what you got. A very fiery performer.
Yeah.
And on the air, he showed all of his emotions. And
like he did on the field.
Yes. And like a fan, he would just weep or, you know, go, you know, you'd hear, oh, no, oh, no. You wouldn't hear any color, but you'd hear, oh, no, oh, no. But it was part of his wonderful personality.
And in 1998, when there was a fly ball down the left field line, that would have ended the game against the Brewers in September of 98. And Pat Hughes says, fly ball to left field. Brant Brown's under it. He drops the ball in here. Oh, no! And it was game over. Cubs lose because Brant Brown dropped the fly ball. Everyone's obviously disappointed. Ron lets it. He's screaming on the air and can't believe it. That was Ron, and that's why we love him.
You know that just about Ron Santo, since you had a chance to get to know him pretty well, it was pretty public knowledge that he was upset about the Hall of Fame bid.
Mm-hmm.
Did he talk to you at all about that on a personal level?
Yeah, we talked, and he talked to a lot of people about it. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that he said it hurt that he didn't get in because he was being human, okay? He wasn't masking it, and he felt he deserved to be in, felt that he'd been snubbed, and knew that it was the luck of the draw with getting the sports writers to vote. But yeah, he was genuinely upset, just like any of us would be upset that we thought we were good enough or qualified enough to get there. Now, true, it's a privilege, and you have to earn that vote, but he felt he had enough to back it up, and rightfully so, even though he wasn't around to enjoy it, rightfully so, he belongs in the Hall of Fame, and he's there.
And, you know, I think what hurt his chances getting back to the 69 Cubs was the 69 Cubs and the fact that they didn't win the championship or at least get to the where they were in the game for the big show. That 69 Cubs, you got to know some of those players too, like Randy Hundley and Glenn Beckert and Don Kessinger, Fergie Jenkins, Billy Williams, just to name a few. Any of those, you have any recollections of those on a one-to-one basis or personal basis when you were working as a director of special events with the Cubs?
Yeah, in fact, Billy Williams, because Billy worked for the Cubs for a while. Mm. He became a dear friend. He lives in Glen Ellen, where we grew up, over on Rain Tree Court, out there near Village Links, right where Bobby Hall used to live when we were growing up in Glen Ellen.
Right.
Billy and his wife, Shirley, are just terrific people, and I got to really get close to Billy. He's a dear friend. And Fergie got to know Randy Hundley, the Rebel, got to know Randy. In fact, I was the official photographer and videographer at Todd Hundley's wedding.
No kidding.
He married a neighbor of ours in Libertyville, three doors down, Tiffany Saarinen. And
oh my goodness, this is old home week here.
And so the Saarinen family said, I said, I'll video it. And so I videoed their wedding. Just great people as players, the 69 Cubs guys, and great people. And that was a team that, while they didn't win the pennant, didn't win the division, they won the World Series in my heart.
Oh, I like that, Connie. You know, speaking of the broadcast booth, we were talking about Tom Brenneman and Ron Santo's memorable day on the microphone, the very first day. You got to know Jack Brickhouse on another level and the Hey Hey.
Mm-hmm.
I understand he was a mentor of sorts to you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So when I say the word Jack Brickhouse, any stories come to mind?
They sure do, pal.
Boy, I tell you, we've got Rich Little here. take this on the road.
Yeah, Jim, you do a heck of a job. I listen to your show and wee, hello. Hey, what a show. We got a winner here. Jack was one of the guys who, again, we learned our ABCs in baseball from Jack Brickhouse growing up.
Mm-hmm.
We probably got our PhD from Harry Carey. How lucky are we in Chicago to have these two great announcers?
Yeah.
Growing up, we would run home from school to watch the Cubs on TV, and there's Jack Brickhouse. When I got to meet Jack.
And that's when there were day games consistently.
Yeah.
So, you go home and he'd be there.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
So Jack would be there for you, and he was your trusted announcer and trusted cheerleader for Cubs baseball. And we learned the game from Jack while we watched the stars perform. And when I got to work with Jack, I would always have him as my PA guy for any special event.
Hmm.
So I would have the timetables of what's going to be going on, and we'd have the day of game activities. And whenever we'd have a special event, old timers game, 8-8-88 for the first night game, division championship, playoff games, anything that was a special event, a magic moment, Ryan Sandberg day, I always asked Jack Brickhouse to be the PA on field. So it would be, ladies and gentlemen, let's go down to the field for our public address announcer for today's special event, Mr. Hey Hey himself, Jack Brickhouse. And Jack would then wait for the applause to die down and get right into his ad libs and his scripted things that I would give him. And he would always tell me whenever I would brief them before, I go, Jack, here's your script for today. He goes, okay, kid, you're like Cecil B. DeMille. You got my script ready for this great production. And he was the guy that also said, I'll work on my ad libs before the game.
I love that. That's a great expression.
It's a great expression, but he's the one that really taught me a lot about public speaking, about how to be an MC, about how to work with the public, about how to do presentations. This is the most worldly broadcaster I think Chicago has ever had in sports, in politics, in all the things that he did on radio and TV. He was the man of all trades, the man of all seasons, and the man of all sports. And I learned so much from Jack Brickhouse.
And you just said another word there, politics. Most people associate him with sports, baseball, the Cubs. But I think he even had a celebrity show for a while where he'd interview celebrities who'd be in town, kind of like an Irv Kupcinet type of thing. But and then, of course, he did the Chicago Bears as well. So
with Irv Kupcinet.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Okay.
That's right, Jack.
In fact, Jack, and another thing that a lot of us growing up in Chicago, the the Bears and other NFL teams would not televise their home games so as to have people come to the game and buy a ticket. And therefore, listening to the game on radio is how we were able to follow home games.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Jack Brickhouse and Irv Cups in it. And it wasn't until later when the NFL developed, let's televise locally, and then had the blackout rule where you had to sell out 48 hours prior to the game in order for it to be televised. If you didn't do those tickets, it would be blacked out. But in the old days, it was radio only. And Jack was great with his play-by-play for the Bears. And he would do something sort of like this. Bears have the balls on the 42.5-yard line. We'll call it the 43. Bill Wade at quarterback. Willie Gallimore in the backfield. He looks out to the right flat. Finds Johnny Morris for a 15-yard gain. Out of bounds. And the Bears have a first down on the Baltimore Colts 42 with 9:42 here to go in the first quarter at a frigid Wrigley Field. Oh, boy. We're on the rally. We're only down by three. What do you think, Cup?
That's right, Jack.
I think you summed it up, Connie. Yeah, not a lot of color there from Cup.
That's right, Jack.
You know, speaking of the broadcasting booth, you mentioned Harry Carey before, previously. Was he the same guy on the air, off the air? I mean, you know, he had this the reputation of being pretty, of a club guy, mm-hmm. You know. What are your memories of him, of Harry Carey? I mean, you had the opportunity to really get... you know, right up close and get to know them at a different level.
Yeah, another great guy, terrific to me. And again, just another Hall of Fame announcer that comes into Chicago, and then I have the privilege to work with him. Absolutely terrific. And with Harry is what you see is what you get. And on the air, off the air, same guy. Gregarious, fun-loving, opinionated, and always loved to be around people to tell stories and talk baseball. He was absolutely magic.
You know, he would get fired, though, because of his opinions. And I think a lot of people were surprised that the Cubs hired him mm-hmm. after he was with the Sox and previously the St. Louis Cardinals because, you know, he would say pretty strident comments.
Mm-hmm.
So was that, did the front office ever worry about Harry when he was on the air? Because there's a lot of tradition, Ivy, you know, seeped up in the Chicago Cubs.
Oh, sure. And, you know.
Were you worried about a loose cannon?
Yeah. You're never worried about a loose cannon, no matter who you hire on the air.
Mm-hmm.
But you want an entertaining, fan-friendly broadcaster. And you want a broadcaster who's emotional, who is into it. And, yeah, if the game has a game-ending double play to lose the game, he's not going to be upbeat. And if he's disappointed, well, that's what the fans are feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And Harry expressed that. You know, his career was built in St. Louis at KMOX. And then he went to the White Sox after he was with the Oakland A's for 1 year. And
forgot about that, yeah.
Yeah, when the Cardinals fired him. And he got hired by Charlie Finley.
Oh, geez.
And then the White Sox hired him. And then in 1981, 82, right around the time that Jack Brickhouse was retiring, that's when Tribune Company owned the team. And I think Jim Dowdle of Tribune Company was responsible for saying, I think if we get this Harry Carey guy, this could boost our fortunes with the Cubs. And they were the ones that got him. And was there risk in having Harry there? Well, first, he was considered a White Sox guy. And that's one thing he had to fight through. But then the other aspect of, would he be a loose cannon? I don't know if that was a big factor and all, because sometimes you go, hey, who cares? We got someone who's the Pied Piper of baseball in Chicago, and we got to have a strong, strong announcer to follow the great Jack Brickhouse. We just can't get somebody from double A ball. And getting Harry Carey was the greatest coup that Tribune and the Cubs ever did.
The reason I mention that is I'm also thinking of Steve Stone, who did speak his onions more or less,
mm-hmm.
and then was let go, wasn't he? For kind of, I guess that's where I'm kind of getting into it, whereas Harry had kind of carte blanche and maybe Steve Stone didn't. Steve Stone was the color announcer with Harry at the time.
Well, and Steve was very much opinionated, but Steve also knew baseball, and he would get into
Cy
the critical.
Young winner, yeah.
Yeah, he would get into the critical component of, you know, and Steve was great because he was a first guesser. He wasn't a second guesser. That's why I love Steve Stone.
First guesser. I like
so
that.
He would be saying, this is a good bunt situation right now for the Cubs to call to move that man to second to set up the game-winning RBI. And then if they didn't bunt and hit into a double play, he would say, that's why you bunt in that situation to move the guy to second. Instead of, oh, you should have bunted. He would say it before it happened, and that's the beauty of Steve Stone. I think he's one of the best analysts because he's a first guesser. But he had some critical comments after the 2004 season, and there's no radios in the dugout or TVs in the dugouts during the game, but the players happened to get wind of some of this, and there was a little friction, and Steve eventually just said, you know what, maybe there's a better pasture, and he's with the Sox, and the Sox are better for it, and the Cubs lost a good announcer.
Yeah, he was just terrific. Thanks for that background there. Yeah, Rhino, we're talking about great Cubs and people that you had a chance to really rub shoulders with. Your memories of Ryan Sandberg, second baseman, Hall of Famer, and now we're moving from the '60s to the '80s in terms of the players. But you were there when Rhino was was an active player.
Yeah, I got to the Cubs in May of 85, and that was a year after the 84 division title, the Sandberg year, the Sandberg game, when he hit the two homers off Suter against the Cardinals in 84. And that 85 season was when I first met Rhino and started working with Rhino, and terrific guy. I don't think there's a harder worker of baseball fundamentals than Ryan Sandberg, and that's why he's a Hall of Famer. He worked
now,
at
his
craft.
Now, why do you say that?
Rhino worked at the game so hard. I almost think, and while we had lots of conversations, I think Rhino was from the old school of, if you don't do your job, perform well, you're going to lose your job and someone's going to take it. And you almost think, Ryan Sandberg, you know, you're the best second baseman. I think he prided himself on his work ethic that he worked so hard because he was always looking behind his shoulder, who may be trying to take my job because if I have a bad day, that's the kind of work ethic and the kind of player you want. But he would take in infield practice every day. He would take ground balls to his left, ground balls to his right, ground balls right at him. And John Vukovich, our coach, would hit that. That was part of his ritual, his mantra, his daily routine. And this guy worked so hard at his game and produced and was the just most terrific Cub player in terms of working hard, and everybody knows his legendary career. He was very soft-spoken,
right,
but he was
right.
very
He wasn't
determined.
A rah-rah guy.
No.
Yeah.
And he was, in fact, I'll tell you a funny story if we have time
yeah,
or if you have to go
ahead.
To break.
Yeah.
But in 1993, Rhino got hurt in spring training early, and he wasn't going to start the season, but he was going to do some rehabbing. And we owned the Orlando Cubs AA team. And so my first thing, I ran that operation for the Cubs and Tribune Company. So I was a mini Steinbrenner in Orlando, where I was the top executive for this minor league team that I was watching as ownership for Tribune Company and the Cubs. We also had a team in Rockford, Illinois.
Right, right.
So I was,
and you're heading out there.
I was heading
yeah,
that
yeah,
up
yeah.
for Tribune, the Cubs, mm-hmm. while based at Wrigley. I had these two minor league fiefdoms that I had to oversee as ownership. Rhino gets hurt, so my thing is, oh my gosh, that's not good for the Cubs and the start of the season in 1993 and all this. And then, okay, he's going to have to get rehabbed, and then he's going to have to play some practice games that, like many big leaguers do, they go to minor league. Get a couple games in, and when they're ready, they go to the bigs. So I am campaigning Rhino should go to Orlando. Warm weather, early in the year. It also can help me get sellouts for my operation. So they decide to send him down to Florida for rehab, and they were going to start him in Daytona because the Orlando Cubs were on the road, and then a couple games in Daytona, our Class A affiliate. And then they were going to have him play in Orlando so we can help boost our business there. So once that happened, all I did in Orlando was say, Ryan Sandberg's going to be playing for the Orlando Cubs in as part of his rehab, and these are the games. Well, those became instant sellouts. People in Orlando who don't get Major League Baseball.
Oh, yeah. See a Hall of Famer?
Exactly. Yeah. So in 94, that or 93, that happened. So it was, they said, hang with Rhino every step of the way. So you'll fly down to Daytona, drive them to Daytona's ballpark.
Oh, you guys really were a close connection there. Yeah.
So, and you'll get them to the hotel, and you'll be his wheel person to ballpark there. And then when it's Orlando, same thing. You guys will drive to Orlando, your operation there, make sure he's set up in his hotel, transportation, so they can get his rehab going. It was the first, and so they got airline tickets for both of us. It was the first time I was ever first class on an airline, as I'm sitting next to, Ryan Sandberg.
That's hard to believe. You had these fiefdoms.
Yeah, yeah. It was Tribune Company and the Cubs. Okay, we're very frugal still, but we're first class. And again, I'm very gregarious. I'm very outgoing. I have a gift of gab. Rhino is very shy, very reticent, very demure. Okay, and people had, you know, we're looking at us going down together for his rehab, and it was the most odd of couples. Yet we got along really well, and yet people thought that he was going to die of an ear injury, and I was going to die of boredom. Okay, and nothing could be further from the truth, as we got along great, and that whole experience. And then after he had his Orlando games, he got called up by the big club and went right from Orlando to Cincinnati to play against the Reds on the road. And but his rehab stint was in Orlando, and I got a chance to meet him. And one of his good friends from where Sandberg lives in Arizona was playing in a golf tournament down there and came to a couple games, and I got to hang with him, and that was Mark Calcavecchia.
Oh, my goodness. What a story. Jeez, Connie. And, you know, real quick on Ryan Sandberg, did he heal completely after that injury? Okay.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, he wrecked his ankle, and he recovered great, and that was 93, and he played for another decade, and the guy had, as you know, one of the greatest careers in Cub history.
Oh, no kidding. And you have had quite a career, to say the least. I'm talking to Connie Kowal, Director of Recreation and the Libertyville Sports Complex. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Connie regarding his 34-year sports career with the Chicago Cubs, the New Orleans Saints, and if we have time, maybe the Chicago Enforcers. We'll have to see, Connie. Plus, Connie will share more highlights about the Chicago Cubs, including one that involves Mike Ditka. You're listening to Word of Mouth. We'll be back right after this. And that's Lone Star, Take Me Out to the Ball Game. And I tell you, Connie, lots of memories with that song. By the way, for just joining us, talking to Connie Kowal, the Director of Recreation in the Libertyville Sports Complex. And I've been talking to Connie about his 34-year sports career with professional sports, including the Chicago Cubs. And we had left off before the break talking about so many of your interesting highlights and stories with your days as Director of Special Events and Minor League Operations. And I'm sure you wore other hats as well when you were with the Cubs. And, you know, when I think of Take Me Out to the Ball Game, that's pretty special when the celebrity would get up and you face the announcer's booth and all Wrigley starts to sing with it. And we've had some notable celebrities, and I believe you were there when Mike Ditka did his rendition. You were right there. What's the backstory on that?
Well, first of all, the whole story is that it's one of the few things in sports where a sport has its own song that everyone sings in the middle of the game. You don't have it in football. You don't have it in basketball. You don't have it in hockey. You have it in baseball. It's special. And in the bottom of the seventh, that was Harry Carey time. And he was the guy that did it. And he started it at Sox Park with Bill Veeck, who heard him sing and then put a microphone in front. And then that's how it started, with him singing to the public. Well, he did that at Wrigley Field. And when Harry passed away in 1998, almost to the day, it was Valentine's Day, 1998, when Harry Carey died. And John McDonough, who was the VP of marketing at the time and that I worked with, and he gave me my start in sports, he came up with the idea, let's have a celebrity do what Harry did.
Did that idea just come to him?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. How could you honor Harry in a tasteful way for something that was absolutely Harry, and that was him singing the anthem to the fans? And John came up with that idea, and then it was developing lists of people that would be able to do it proud, make the Cubs proud, and make Harry proud, and also make Dutchie, Harry's wife, and Chip, his son, who was a broadcaster with the Cubs, have them say that's a respectful way for people to remember our husband, our father, our grandfather, and one of many great ideas the McDonough's had. But anyway,
well, actually, before we get into Ditka, I have a question about that. How are those celebrities like Ditka? How do you determine who's going to be singing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" on which day? Whose job is that to?
Well, there's a guy assigned to that. In fact, Jim Mabojkowicz, who's with the Cubs now, that's his job. He's a Libertyville guy. And I should introduce you to him, and he lives in Libertyville like us, and he's the one that puts together the game day entertainment. But back in the embryonic days when this started, we would sit and brainstorm, and we would say, who would be good to do this?
So you were involved in that process?
Yes, John, me, Jay Blunk, and others in the marketing department. It would be, who would be a person who's in town that could do it? Who's a person who's coming to town? It might be Joe Buck, the Cardinal broadcaster, who was Harry's partner. And you do it during a Cardinal series when Joe's there.
Mm-hmm.
Or a guy like Bob Uecker when the Brewers came to town. And you would say, hey, could you do it in the seventh inning as a tribute to Harry? Of course I would. And sometimes it got to be where it was Bob Costas who was in town. Or it might be an actor.
Bill Murray comes to mind with
Bill
me.
Murray. Okay, yeah. So you have all these. And so you sort of look and see who's coming in town, who's in town. And then just start scheduling like you would. Scheduling someone to come in to do a certain performance at a theater. And the calendar built and the requests.
So you ultimately were getting requests then?
Oh, people said, hey, I'll do it. So we had people who wanted to do it besides us asking them, and it just snowballed. And now there's probably a waiting list for people to say, hey, I'd love to come in and do it. I'll be in town to do a book signing for whatever. And so now they're inundated with that. But it was a great thing, and it's a great way to remember Harry, and the fans love it, and it's one of the signature moments. That when people come to the ballpark, it's almost Pavlovian. After the third out in the top of the seventh, everyone gets up for the seventh inning stretch, and they turn, look to the booth, and then say, I wonder who that celebrity is today. And it adds to the mystique the entertainment value of coming to Wrigley Field, which leads us to Mike Ditka. The day that Mike Ditka was the celebrity singer happened to be a Sunday in July in 1998, and he was the guest announcer, and he was running late.
Okay.
He was playing golf in the northern suburbs, and Mike loves golf, and he's running late. So you can imagine him playing golf at Bobolink or Glen Flora or some
Highland
North Shore.
Park or whatever. Yeah.
Having to say, hey, guys, I got to get down to Wrigley. I'm supposed to sing the seventh inning stretch. And we're up there in the press box area, and there's no Mike Ditka. And Steve Stone was going to be the backup in case he didn't show. All of a sudden, and we have no elevators at Wrigley, that can really work. Mike comes running. All of a sudden, he comes running up this. We get a report at the front desk. Ditka's here. Well, we can't wait all day for the seventh inning stretch. You only have so much time because of commercial breaks. The game's got to go on. It goes on time. You got to be up there. Mike comes running. Comes running, blows right past me, goes in the broadcast booth. He's absolutely out of breath, and that's when he did the 30-second take me out to the ball game where, you know, it was the old take me out to the ball game, take me out of the crowd, and it's 1, 2, 3 strikes are out. Oh, ball game. When he does one of these, and the place goes crazy, and they go right to commercial break. And I remember that because that was my last day with the Cubs.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's when I left there to go to the Chicago Motor Speedway. And so that was my last day with the Cubs, and that was the day that Ditka had the great take me out to the ball game thing.
On YouTube, I think it's gotten almost 1 million hits or something like that, thousands and thousands of hits. It's just now we know the backstory, which is really interesting.
That's why he did it quickly. That's why he was out of breath, because he was hustling to get there because his golf game ran late, and he had to get there and do his obligation to sing take me out to the ball game.
It really wasn't about a singing style then. Yeah, or
you know what? I'm not going to argue with Mike about anything regarding style or anything.
Good
but
point,
Mike's a great guy, and he actually signed a photo that was me and him in the dugout when he threw out a first pitch opening day in the late 80s, just after his hip surgery. Mm. And there it is, me and Mike in the dugout. And I said, hey, Mike, this is my last day with the Cubs. He goes, yeah, that's what I heard. He goes, good luck. And then he signed the photo, Connie, good luck, Mike Ditka. And it's one of my prized possessions.
Over the break, you said you had another Jack Brickhouse story.
Yeah.
You want to share that then?
Well, I've got thousands of Brickhouse stories, and my buddies all know him because I tell them. And John Fischel, by the way, who lives in Libertyville, who is the assistant athletic director at Libertyville High School, one of my dearest friends, blood brother, who's listening to the broadcast right now, because people out there, you've heard that ding in the background. That is my fans out there listening to this broadcast saying, Connie mentioned my name. Well, John Fischel, I'm mentioning your name, who's listening right now at Libertyville High School. But I played in a celebrity golf outing with Jack Brickhouse at Olympia Fields, and it was me, Jack Brickhouse, Dan Rohn from Channel 9, mm-hmm. Steve Shanwald of the Bulls, and Jerry Krause. And so it was a...
That's an interesting mix.
Yeah, and it was...
Jerry Krause.
He was general manager of the
Bulls. The Bulls, yeah.
And it was for baseball cancer charities, and, you know, you put your guys in order when you play, and Dan Rohn, who's a scratch golfer, he was like our anchor, and Brick was like 70-something, hit it straight but not very far, so he was our leadoff guy. So he was the first guy to hit and get it in position and all that. So we get to the first green, and we come up with an order of who's going to putt, and if anybody out there in the listening audience has played in a scramble, you want to have an order of people so that you can maybe get your best guys toward the end in case the first guy's missed. The last guy may knock that putt in to help your score as a scramble team. Jack was the first putter. It was about a 15-footer. He knocks it in for birdie. And we're like, yeah, we have the big birdie cheer. We high-five, and nobody needs to putt. We go to the second hole. We're on the green. Let's keep the same order. And Brick goes, okay, kid, see if I can do it again. Drills in a 20-footer for birdie. We're high-fiving. We get to the third hole. Keep the same order. Brick knocks in an eagle putt, and all of a sudden we're like, this is great. Fourth hole, Brick's first guy to putt, knocks it in. Fifth hole, knocks it in for birdie. We are like six under after five.
This is crazy.
And yeah. Brickhouse is our leadoff man, and he's made his putt, and we never have had to putt. We get to the sixth hole, Jack hits his putt, just misses it. Now the second guy's up there, he's got the knees knocking, he hasn't putted all day. And he misses wildly. I haven't putted all day. I'm not even close. We've never practiced our putts. We developed the Brickhouse rule. If you're ever in a scramble and the first guy makes the putt and everyone's cheering, everybody else putt to keep your game in form, because when it is your turn, you better be fresh and you better be ready to go. Not, I haven't putted for six holes. We were all untested in our putting. It becomes the Brickhouse rule.
That is very interesting. That's great.
So yeah, anybody in a scramble? Yeah, it's great that the guy had made his putt and you don't need to putt. Practice your putt anyway because they may need you the next hole. And that was the Brickhouse rule.
It'll catch up with you later.
Because that sixth hole, we were all out there. Our knees are knocking. We had no touch, no feel. So now when I play in scrambles, I go, here's the Brickhouse rule.
You know, all these people you've had a chance to meet, and a lot of that is because of director of special events, I'm assuming. And
it's just from my career in sports. I've been lucky to be with people who are in the sports world that is my world. And the people in the sports world, many of them are celebrities. They're sports stars. How lucky am I to rub elbows with them as a sports executive? So whether it's soccer, baseball, football, NFL football, motor racing, I've been lucky to be. And then you go to events that bring celebrities to it, and you're now part of that fraternity. So you get to meet people from all sports, your town, other towns. I've had the privilege to meet so many people by working in sports. I'm the luckiest guy in the world.
Well, let's think. I'm going to talk about rock and roll for a little bit. And comes to mind is America's oldest teenager, Dick Clark.
American Bandstand.
Yeah. And so did he throw out the first pitch? Mm-hmm. What was his role at Wrigley Field?
One of the things we would do, and all sports teams do it, but at the Cubs, we were always very, very progressive and aggressive in finding celebrities that could come to Wrigley Field and be part of the show. Dick Clark was being inducted into the Broadcast Museum Hall of Fame, the museum
in
downtown
Chicago.
That Bruce DeMont orchestrates and runs as executive director. And he was coming into town for that. And Bruce said, hey, I got Dick Clark coming to be inducted in the Broadcast Museum Hall of Fame downtown. And it gave us a chance to promote his museum as well as us to bring another celebrity star on the field in pregame ceremonies. So Dick Clark was the first pitch celebrity that day. And I remember going up to him and said, Dick, when I tap you on the shoulder, you're going to walk out to the mound. Don't throw until I give you the signal. because we want to make sure your name is on the center field scoreboard. We want to make sure that Wayne Mesmer reads the introduction for you and gives the build-up. The fans will all applaud. You wave to the fans, and then you throw the first pitch. And after you throw it, you walked off the mound. You go to the catcher. He gives you the ball. He'll sign it for you. You wave to the crowd. You come with me, and we walk you off the field to your seats and all that.
Sounds very organized.
And that's what you do when you prepare people for these situations. Dick Clark says, I got to go all the way out there. I said, yeah, that's what you sort of do with the first pitch. You go out to the pitching mound.
Oh, no.
He goes, all the way out there? And I go, yeah. He goes, I'm a little nervous. And I got to throw it to, and I go, yeah, that's what a first pitch is, Dick, okay? He starts getting real nervous. And I go, you're nervous? He goes, yeah. Do I have to go all the way out to the mound? Could I go like maybe just on the grass, maybe 10 feet away and throw it? I said, well, Dick, you sort of got to get out there a little bit.
I got to get out there a little bit.
Okay. And he goes, I'm a little nervous. I've never done this before. And all these people. And I go, you're Dick Clark, American Bandstand from Philadelphia, PA, millions of people, live TV. And you're nervous? He goes, yeah. He goes, this isn't what I usually do. Mm. And I said, Dick, you'll do great. You take the ball, walk out there, do everything I told you, wave to the crowd. So I got all this confidence built up. I'm trying to perk up Dick Clark.
Yeah, yeah. Thank goodness you're there.
So sure enough, he walks out to the field. Wayne Mesmer introduces him. He stands out there. His name's on the scoreboard. He waves to the crowd. Jody Davis is the catcher. And Dick Clark looks at him, gets ready to throw. And he froze in nervousness so much that the ball stuck in his hand and he spiked it.
Oh, no.
Instead of it going all the way to the catcher. So he spiked it and it dribbled like 10 feet. And it's just sitting there on the grass before home plate. And all the crowd is, they're applauding. And Jody picks it up and says, nice pitch, and does all the things. And, yeah, Dick Clark spiked his first pitch.
Jeez, I'm sure a lot of the people who do the first pitch are pretty nervous about that.
Of course.
Because that's always a farther away than you think it's going to be.
Yeah, it's farther away, and your tendency is to throw straight at the catcher. The ball's going to go down. So we always told people, aim high, because it's got to come down. Figuring they don't have a 90-mile-an-hour fastball. They got probably a 40-mile-an-hour fastball. It's going to come on an arc. Aim it high. It'll come in. One guy we told it to, he decided to throw it as hard as he could. He whistled one over the catcher's head, hit the bricks, and almost killed the fan. So this last summer when you saw that guy, 50 Cent or whatever, that you saw in the bloopers.
And he said,
some guys freeze up. They're nervous. You get one shot, one chance, and you got to be accurate. So there'll be a whole different segment in my book as to celebrity first pitches and how they turned out.
I mentioned rock and roll. One guy that you met that I always enjoyed very much, Huey Lewis in the News. Was that through a concert that he came that you were able to get to know him then?
Yeah, same thing. You have people coming to town for a concert, and they would love to come to a game. And entertainers want to be athletes, and athletes want to be entertainers. You know, baseball players want to be rock stars in a band, and bands members want to be a baseball player.
Right, right.
Eddie Vedder, Pearl Jam.
Right,
If he could be a rock and roll star or a Cubs player, he'd be a Cubs player.
Mm-hmm.
Huey Lewis came out because he was performing at the old Poplar Creek music venue in Hoffman Estates.
Well, that's kind of where the Sears Center is now.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
And so he was in town. We invited him to sing the national anthem. He did. And I got to meet Huey Lewis and then go to his concert that night.
Oh, how fun.
And hang out with him at Wrigley Field. And afterwards, when he came and he was done with the concert and backstage and all that, and he sees me, because I told him I had my tickets, I'd be there, and he goes, Connie, how you doing? My wife, Sally, couldn't believe it as he calls us up to have a little, you know, chance to chat and stuff like that. And I've seen him at three or four other concerts, and each one of them I've been able to go backstage and say hi to Huey Lewis, and he's one of my, besides the Beatles, he's one of my favorite performers.
One of my fans, too. And Connie, I am enjoying this so much. You're listening to Word of Mouth. I'm Jim Wunderlich. We're talking to Connie Kowal, the Director of Recreation in the Libertyville Sports Complex, and his years in the front office with the Chicago Cubs. You're listening to Word of Mouth. More after this. You know, I never get tired of that song, Connie.
It's a great tune.
That, of course, is Running Down a Dream by Tom Petty. And
The Heartbreakers.
And The Heartbreakers. And You know, Connie, you've been running down a lot of dreams with your career in sports administration in the front office of so many organizations, and we've spent most of our time talking about the Chicago Cubs and some wonderful stories. But I'd be remiss if we didn't, before the end of the show, talk a little bit about your experience with the New Orleans Saints. And, you know, maybe we can, when you come back next time, we can spend a little time on that as well. But you left the Cubs, and you had some other jobs in there too. Mm-hmm. But the New Orleans Saints, what is interesting to me and a more poignant thing, I mean, you were there during Hurricane Katrina.
Right.
And your experiences are really unrivaled by other people. Because the Saints went through quite a bit during that, to say the least.
Yeah, we were America's gypsies. We were America's orphans when Katrina hit New Orleans August 29th, 2005. This year, it'll be the 10th remembrance this August of Katrina. It's not an anniversary. Bad things, you don't say anniversaries.
Mm.
It's a remembrance of August 29th, 2005, when Katrina hit the Gulf South. And yeah, I was there. I was the senior director of marketing for the New Orleans Saints. It was my third season with the Saints. And for a Northern boy experiencing a hurricane and how people live it when it happens or how they prepare for it. And then this one was the big one. Yeah, I experienced it like the hundreds of thousands of people in the Gulf South.
Also, the New Orleans Saints, didn't they have to move to San Antonio because the Superdome was just totaled, right?
Yeah, and I remember I evacuated like you're supposed to do. You're supposed to get out of there. In fact, I was told, hey, Northern boy, we got a little thing down here called hurricane season. And me being from Chicago and, you know, having a little bit of a sense of humor, said, hurricane season, is that like the holiday season? Or, you know, and they said, no, from June 1 to Thanksgiving, be ready to skedaddle for 3 days, because when a hurricane comes, you need to get out, and then you come back, you squeegee things up, mop it up, take the plywood off, and life goes on. With this one, it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
There's still people who have not returned to New Orleans. But in the case of the Saints, we relocated all of our operations and had to instantly change our whole thing with 2 weeks before the start of the NFL season and have San Antonio be our base of operations. I remember the morning of August 29th watching the Today Show, and I'm in a hotel room in Houston, and who do I see on the air reporting live from inside the Superdome? Ironically, Brian Williams saying, and the roof of the Superdome is being ripped apart by these winds and hurricane force. I knew at that moment we weren't going to be playing at the Superdome, and we'd have to play someplace else, and it ended up being in the city of San Antonio, Texas, and it'll be in the book about Hurricane Katrina under Kay. And it was, I lived it like many, many other people. And we started up from scratch our NFL season in 2005. And people all watched the plight of the New Orleans Saints besides the misfortune of so many people in the Gulf South.
Well, I tell you what, why don't we do this? You know, we are running short of time, but let's plan on you coming back in August if you're available.
Let's
and we
do
can,
it.
And we can talk a little bit about your experience in New Orleans and, oh, geez, you know, all the other teams that you've been a part of, too, as well as the Chicago Cubs. Before we go, though, your present job has to deal with being director of recreation in the Libertyville Sports Complex. Any activities that you want to mention before we make a run here?
Sure. Thank you, Jim, for allowing that, because the Libertyville Sports Complex is just a fantastic opportunity, as your listeners know who live up here in Lake County. And come visit us if you haven't been there. But 2 indoor soccer fields, 8 basketball courts, our own fitness center, a driving range that guys are hitting golf balls today in the middle of February. We have everything for people in terms of sports and recreation, whether it's to have open gym, shoot some hoops, or rent our facility out for a special event, private event, and we're the home to basketball tournaments. We're the campus for fun in Lake County.
Any special events coming up that we should be aware of?
Yeah, in fact, I'll tell you
one. Might be kind of fun for the listeners.
For people listening 2 months from now, okay, so it gives you a little lead time, April 9th, a Thursday, it is our 5th annual Chicago Blackhawks Road Watch Party, where we watch the Blackhawks play on a road. I have a big screen TV in the sports complex. We sell 500 tickets. That's it. Get your tickets now. 847-918-7275. It's family friendly. No alcohol. It's family friendly. Bring your kids. and 500 fans get a chance to watch the Hawks on TV, and the Blackhawks visit us, and they bring Jim Cornelius in to sing the anthem.
Oh, geez, that would give you chills.
Yep, they bring a celebrity. They've had Dennis Savard, Tony Esposito, who've been there in the past, the Ice Crew Girls, Tommy Hawk, the mascot, one of the best brands in Chicago sports, the Blackhawks, have a big event in our sports complex, so don't miss it, Lake County.
Boy, it sounds just terrific, Connie. Connie, thanks for being on the program today.
Thank
really
you,
appreciate
Jim.
It. If you wish to contact Connie Kowal and learn more about the Libertyville Sports Complex and the events that they have, you may contact him at www.libertyville.com. And thank you for tuning in. I hope you drop by again next Thursday at 11 a.m. when we talk to another captivating guest on Word of Mouth.